Now, before we dive into today's episode of Be Good and Rewatch It, you should know that there are a couple caution warnings for this episode for sexual and physical abuse and domestic violence. Serenity is a very silly movie in a lot of ways, but also deals with some troubling themes in a not always and frequently massively inappropriate way. We'll be discussing all of that on the show, but you should just be advised going into this that this conversation does end up in some pretty serious and dark places.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So, I guess we're doing this.
Hell yeah, we're doing this. I'm
like,
ready.
This is the last chance. We could just talk about something else. Like
Apex Legends, baby.
Let's go.
I'm going to not talk about how excited I am for Apex Legends in order to talk about something else.
Which, all right. Are we excited?
To talk about it?
You know what? Be it on your heads, be it on Patrick's. Welcome to Be Good and Rewatch It, a Waypoint podcast where we take a close look at movies and television, examine their themes, craft new relationship to our own times, and for some reason,
we do that?
At our best.
We try. Yeah. I mean, Natalie, we aspire to greater things. Whether we reach them is immaterial. Look, you think there's documentary evidence that the movie we're talking about today, that's not what people thought they were getting into.
No.
And yet.
And like, yet.
And yet.
The angels of our better nature.
So for some sort of reason, we're looking this week at Serenity, a new thriller from writer-director Steven Knight and starring
creator
Anne
of
co-creator.
Co-creator of Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? He co-created that in the UK.
Was that, was the original. That was the original,
yes.
Wasn't it?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
Yep.
His IMDb entry as a writer is illuminating, and we'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah, we'll get there.
So sorry, it's starring Anne Hathaway and Matthew McConaughey. The movie currently has a 22% on Rotten Tomatoes and gave both actors their worst film opening of their careers.
Damn. Can I just say, I think it's at least a 25.
I agree.
Okay,
but that's
sure.
Not how Rotten Tomatoes work. That's aggregation. Yeah, that's just.
Yeah. I'll give the 3%.
Thank you.
It's apples and Rotten Tomatoes that you're comparing. So today we are going to plumb the murky depths of this bizarre and often misguided film. We're going to spoil it from the jump because this movie cannot be understood or even discussed outside the context of its overarching conceit. We already spoiled it on another podcast where Patrick cracked open this Pandora's box, but in case you didn't listen to that, again... There are significant spoilers for Serenity, a movie that I'm sure everybody here was keenly anticipating seeing and going in completely unspoiled. Anyway, this is your chance to turn back. I'm your host, Rob Zachney. Joining me today for this very special episode is Austin Walker.
Hello.
And Natalie Watson.
Hi.
I think Kato also needs to be able to talk during this because
Kato
came to the movie theater with us.
Hi.
Well, Kato's background in art, I'll bet Kato got it. I'll bet Kato was like, y'all
Kato,
are cool.
Kato has a film degree, I'm pretty sure, right?
No, I did film in high school.
Okay.
And then I switched to fucking fine art.
So were your works better or worse than Serenity?
I don't know. I mean, I did make a short run live action Sailor Moon before that existed. So.
Hell yeah.
Wow, ahead of your time.
Key thing here. For the post on this, and I would say for the episode art, we just use the Joss Whedon Serenity.
Yeah, 100%.
It'll improve engagement like tenfold.
100%.
God damn it.
100%. Yep. I was going to do that bit. I was going to come in and be like, wait, I saw, you're talking about Serenity, right? With Alan Tudyk and Mal Reynolds. He's like, boom, bing, bing, guns, spaceships.
I don't know this.
Do you not know Serenity?
No.
Serenity is great. Here's
the Confederacy
why I like
was awesome.
The Confederacy was awesome. Firefly is bad. Firefly is the thing that tricks you to think it's good until you like pause in any way and think about it. Here is my favorite thing about Serenity is it's a great case study. Serenity 2005, Joss Whedon. In there being a movie actor in a film filled with TV actors, and it's showing.
Oh, Chiwetel Ejiofor?
Yeah.
Just fucking Ejiofor, blowing the doors off that movie.
It's unbelievable. He's so fucking good. And he's playing like the villain, which means he's already going to scene steal because it's like a well enough written villain. And because when you stop and think about the good guys, a lot of the reason you like them kind of falls apart. And then this character is just built to make all of that very fucking clear and delivered by someone who is, if he's not yet won an Academy Award, he certainly will. He may have
Ejiofor concerns me because he is such a brilliant actor, but I'm not sure he's gotten the roles. A Slave was his big breakout.
Yeah, that's
but
what
the
I
thing
was
is, like, he keeps getting caught up either in these big prestige pieces,
yeah,
or he's a bit player put in to lend gravitas to like a genre production.
Yes, that happens a lot with him, and it's a shame.
Hey, friends. We gathered here to talk about a different movie called Serenity. And we're going to have to talk about it. We can't beat around this bush.
Hey, you guys, you see the giant bomb, like quick look of Apex Legends just hit.
Oh, cool.
That's cool.
Brad seemed really excited about that game.
Yeah, Brad seems really, really excited about it. There's a robot. Not big robots, there's little robots.
There's Chappie.
There's Chappie right here. can we talk about Chappie?
On their future.
Now, Chappie. Now, Chappie.
That's a be good.
That's a fucking be good.
I've never seen it.
We should see
Wait,
Chappie.
Really?
There's
I haven't seen.
That's a good
why
robot
is anyone
right
surprised when I say I haven't seen a movie?
takes a consciousness, no problem.
Like, the best thing about Chappie is in that movie, consciousness is constantly stored on little data disks, and they all have just like written in Sharpie consciousness.dat on them. Like there's a universal file format for like minds. It's great. Chappie is conscious. Chappie is a person. But in a robot body.
That's Chappie.
You get put into a robot, but you're all fucked up because somebody used a freeware like decompression software to like 100%. Extract you onto the robot. God. Anyway, Serenity is
2018.
Can we run through
19?
19.
When did it come out?
19. The year is currently 2019.
Did this movie fuck you up so bad you forgot what day it is?
I wasn't sure if it came out like a while ago and we just got around to it or if it...
You thought this movie was maybe in theaters for over a month.
Duh. Now that I think about it, that would be hard.
Anyway.
So, Serenity is, I guess you'd call it like... It falls in the tradition of like what were called erotic thrillers or romantic thrillers.
Yes.
And it is a sort of neo-noir set in a tropical locale starring Matthew McConaughey as kind of a down on his luck.
Baker Dale.
Yep. Down on his luck fisherman named Baker
down
Dale.
His luck, a down on his luck Pokemon. Baker Dale. Baker Dale. Baker Dale.
He is a world-class fisherman, but he is reduced to taking rich tourists out on the water so that they can try to catch trophy fish, prize fish. And he is just in a process of like slow degradation into bankruptcy. He's basically only being like kept afloat, so to speak, by this woman, Constance, who lives in his seaside port town, who... He is sort of dating, but also she has sex with him and gives him money to give him fuel to keep going out on the water each day.
If she's not giving him money for sex, she's giving him money for finding her cat, is what I came to understand. Yep.
She's keeping him in the green. Like, she's making sure he's all right.
Yeah.
I have so many questions about this particular element of when we get to the reveal. There's a lot of questions about a lot of this movie. Anyway,
his first mate on his boat is this character named Duke, played by Jaimin Hansu, who is basically the, again, Cassandra type figure. He's the wise first mate who's there to tell the captain, like, I don't know if we should be doing this, captain. You seem to be increasingly losing your cool and unfit to do anything out on the water. And into this mix, as Baker Dill is basically living day to day, paycheck to paycheck, constantly like about to break, into this mix comes his ex-wife, played by Anne Hathaway, Karen Zariakis. And it is clear from the time they meet that they split up shortly after he went to Iraq.
Yeah.
And she has since remarried. He disappeared. She has been trying to track him down for a while. She is remarried and she is trapped in an abusive marriage. And she would like, she is going to bring her new husband, played by Jason Clark, Frank Zariakis. She is going to bring her new husband down to this seaside town, Plymouth, and she is going to put him on Baker Dill's boat, and she wants Baker Dill to sail her husband out to the deep water and dump and kill him and dump him overboard. She wants Matthew McConaughey to murder her husband.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But from the first, there are weird interstitial cuts.
And by the way, you say first, you don't mean the first moment that she arrives. You mean from the beginning of the movie.
Yes.
Which opens with just this blasting, like not like just generic butt rock with a weird typeface treatment for the word Serenity that appears. I think it is so important to understand that this movie is filled from top to bottom with strange choices, strange formalistic choices around, like you said, cuts, camera motion, musical choice, dialogue, the cadence of certain pieces of dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
It feels strange. And this is why it's a 25 and not a 22, because that does pay off.
Here's my thing. Yeah. Also, forgot to mention that also trapped in this abusive familial relationship is Baker and Karen. Baker and Karen, classic American family. Baker and Karen's son.
Patrick.
Patrick, yes, Patrick.
Protect our sweet boy.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Our sweet boy Patrick.
Our sweet gamer boy. It's true.
Truly. He's there.
Well, and he is a gamer. Like, it's established pretty early on that in response to the situation at home, he has thrown himself into games.
Yeah.
And has built himself a home VR setup where he is playing on his computer with a blanket draped over his shoulders and over the monitor. We all remember this.
Who has not? Yeah.
And so he is basically trying to, he is hiding from this abusive relationship. And when you see the shots from his point of view, every time you see his room and he's playing a game, you get some glimpse of what he's playing. There's lots of variables. It looks like he's in some sort of world builder. And then in the background, you hear basically domesticabuse.wave is what is playing in the background. Like, it is just, you hear shouting, fighting, like lots of upsetting background noise from what is presumably Anne Hathaway's character being assaulted by her husband, Frank, played by Jason Clark, who, by the way, we talked about this last week. Jason Clark is suddenly in everything.
Yeah.
Best known for perhaps The Chicago Code, a totally all right police procedural that was canceled after, I think, 13 episodes. But anyway, Jason Clark appears to be filling that James Caan role where if you need to cast kind of an asshole, who you would totally buy as being like an abusive creep or just kind of a shitty husband, Jason Clark appears to be who producers have on speed dial right now. Jason Clark, talk to your agent. Anyway, so the thing I want to lay out here is that I think one reason Serenity has been oddly received is because it is operating in a tradition that we just do not see many movies like this at all anymore. It is a it is a meta movie about a genre that has largely, I think, dried up and died off. But the thing to bear in mind is that film noir sort of comes into vogue in like the mid to late 40s and reaches its like apogee in the late 40s, early 50s. And film noir is dealing with a lot of themes, a lot of them around suppressed sexuality, because films are still laboring, if not outright under the production code.
Yes.
But
they are that, and yet there is also, socially, we have discarded the notion of innocence. We know better about people by the 40s and the 50s. The world, we've all confronted things, let's say, in the 30s and 40s, which have made it impossible for us to enjoy entertainment. Not impossible, and not us is the broadest category. I'm being very generalistic here. But as creators and as film-going audiences, the audiences were increasingly interested in films that at least recognized a fallibility of the hero, that recognized corruption both in personal affairs and governmental and business affairs, both kind of in the personal and private, or public and private. And we recognize that there were often not clean solutions, that both the heroes who were set to break mysteries open were rarely the kind of cool and collected Poirot figures, who, not to say Poirot is someone who does not have his own baggage, but we're not simply master detectives, but we're often insurance salesmen who were divorced or whatever. And then that the solutions rarely cleaned things up, that mm-hmm. solving the mystery rarely ended with, and then the good guys win and the bad guys go to jail, the end.
The sort of the foundational work of film noir is Double Indemnity, which hits before World War II is even over. Important thing to note for all of this is film noir, it's remembered as Barbara Stanwyck being a femme fatale who talks and otherwise straight shooting insurance salesman into murder. Crucially, what is forgotten in that is he talks himself into it as much as she does. Like, it is a collaborative project from the start. It's interesting that it's always remembered as he's completely manipulated. We've watched the film, it's not really the case at all. But film noir tends to follow these tropes, and then as the mores of the 40s and 50s drop away, the production act is completely abandoned. You sort of have the laughably incomplete so-called sexual revolution of the 60s. And then you get sort of a new generation of noirs, that both neo-noirs, but then there's erotic thrillers. And like, it's almost a remake of Double Indemnity, but like one of the best versions of this is a movie from 1981 called Body Heat by Lawrence Kasdan, starring Kathleen Turner and William Hurt. And basically, Body Heat is, what if you combine Double Indemnity with the aesthetic sensibility of a mid-1970s issue of Penthouse or Playboy?
Right. I was going to say, not even Penthouse's degree of pornography, a little softer core than that, right?
But yeah, but a little harder than Playboy.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, yes. Body Heat, it's like, let's get some fucking going in this movie. And it's crucial because you almost have to believe in Body Heat that the obviously corrupt bargain that William Hurt's character is making might almost be worth it because the relationship is so intense. Right. Also, really good Ten Danson performance, just FYI, worth watching for that. But these movies existed for a while.
They were listed to like the late 90s, right? Is that fair?
What would be your late 90s examples?
I'm thinking of like Bound. I'm thinking of Cruel Intentions. Yeah. I'm thinking of Eyes Wide Shut. I don't think they go into the 2000s.
And they're starting to lose their film noir.
Oh, absolutely. They're still horny, but they're not quite neo-noirs. Right?
Right. And so you start to see that drop away. And then there's sort of a movement toward overall prudishness in the 90s, 2000s, where like just the erotically charged adult movie, like it's not like an adult film in the pornography sense, but just like has like explicit sexuality. Mm-hmm. A lot of that just disappears from filmmaking entirely, certainly from mainstream filmmaking. And so Serenity, the weird thing is, I think it belongs in this lineage of neo-noirs and erotic thrillers. The problem is nobody's seen one of those fucking movies. Not really. Nobody's seen one in like 20 years. Gone Girl is the last great
Gone Girl.
Neo-noir. Yeah. Like, and that's sort of a throwback, but it is very much, I would argue, one of the most distinctly unerotic erotic thrillers I've ever seen.
It's a question. I'm just now realizing. Do we know when this movie is set?
It doesn't matter, I think.
Based on the PC, we can kind of guess.
Right. And also based on what war, what was it, Iraq War?
Iraq,
war?
Yeah.
Okay.
6 years he was deployed.
I'm guessing it's like late aughts.
Late aughts, early 2010s.
Early teens.
Yeah. Sorry, that's not true. I actually let's see here, because the war against the Federation, obviously, you know, when Mal Reynolds and the crew of the Firefly, it was the 26th century. 26th century is when the humanity left an overpopulated Earth to colonize a new solar system.
Yeah, thank you. Perfect.
You're welcome.
This is going to be confusing.
So this movie checks a bunch of those boxes, though. You have the down on his luck, small town guy in the tropics, just steamy, everyone's sweating all the time, just not many clothes.
And Matthew McConaughey is hot as shit. Like, everyone is hot. Like, I'm not, they're, like, everyone is hot.
Yeah.
Who plays the, Diane Lane plays Constance. Hot. Like, everybody is hot in
everyone
this movie.
Is
you get a lot of
attractive.
Matthew McConaughey butt in this movie.
Yeah. You sure
a
fucking lot. Do.
He doesn't have a great butt, but it's all right.
There's gyrating.
There's like a couple of really bad sex scenes, but they're in there. And you're right that there are a lot of thrillers. Yeah, we do.
We have to talk about those specifically for the thing that we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah. Right. We'll get. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this movie checks a lot of those boxes.
Oh, right, it has one more great thing from neo-noir, which is a man in a suit in the rain trying to contact the protagonist.
That's a really good point.
It has an outsider who seems to know something the hero doesn't want to be bothered with. I love this character. Reed Mitchell is the name of the character in the movie. He has another name, played by Jeremy Strong. We'll get to that other name momentarily also. fuck.
Yeah. So the thing is, though, no sooner, does... It might even start happening before
it does.
His wife makes the offer.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah. But... For instance, there's weird cuts, there's jumps in continuity. There's a point where he goes from a convert, Constance, Diane Lane's character, comes and visits him at his bungalow, which is really just a trailer with a window. It's a shipping crate, right?
Yes, it's like a metal ship. Doesn't have any lights inside. He has a lamp that he can turn the lights on in. He only does it once in the whole movie.
Looks pretty cool, actually. It does look he's pretty got cool. His clips
so this
himself.
Is the thing, 25, 30? Could be a 30. Yeah.
But she comes, visits him, he walks out of the conversation, strips naked, jumps into the water off the cliff, dives into the water, and while he's down there, he catches a glimpse of another figure in the water looking at him, and he hears a child calling his name.
Mm.
And that is our first indication that what we have here is not just... a neo-noir, not just a neurotic thriller, but a movie about video game modding and gamers rising up.
God.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
In the words of anime genre is an isekai, which means another world. These are anime where a character goes from their normal life into a strange and mysterious one, like into a video game or the past, or a battler Dunbine. Right. Anyone? No? Okay. All my anime fans out there. See, I was trying to connect gaming and anime, great tastes.
So.
Yeah.
But I would argue, so everyone's saying this is a huge twist. I don't think it's a twist.
I don't think it's a twist either.
This is shown so early in the film.
It's only a twist because of the trailer.
Right. So that's an important thing. Do you want to talk about the trailer
a little bit?
Which I just watched for the first time.
The trailer I had seen several times in the movie theaters, and I was like, what the fuck is this movie? And basically, the story that the trailer tells is the one that we've laid out so far, in which... there is a fisherman who's looking for this specific fish. He's got this specific large fish on the mind. A tuna, in fact.
Do you remember the tuna's name?
What's it called?
Justice.
God.
His boat is called Serenity, so that's the titular thing.
Yeah.
So he's visited by a woman. You can kind of tell that it's his ex-wife. I think they say that in the trailer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then she tells him about the abusive husband and tells him that he has to, like, she needs him to kill him. And that's it?
The suit guy is there.
The suit guy is there, who says, the thing that you do get is everyone saying, you know,
do the right thing or whatever.
Do the right thing. Everyone says that, you know, everyone knows everything in Plymouth.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you do get Plymouth. In the trailer the interaction with the storekeeper who, like, owns the bait shop or whatever, in which she, like, delivers sort of, like, this warning or something, or she, like, delivers a line, and then Matthew McConaughey says something like, is this even real? And then she says, well, she, like, kind of, like, has this...
So you know something is going on.
Yeah.
But that could be like...
She like reverts to basically her greeting, like what she would say like when you first walk in or something like, well, have a good day now.
You've exhausted all of the dialogue, basically, which we're getting close now to. I mean, yeah, it's a video game. It's a video game.
That's the twist.
But that sequence is great. That trailer could very well be something like The Wicker Man or any other thriller where it's like, ah, small town with a secret. Small town that is going to kill this protagonist eventually because it is a secret cult, or it is, there is something ancient and evil underneath the lake or the water here, or something like that, right? Like, it could have been one of those.
Totally.
And instead...
It's
not just a video game,
it
right?
It is not.
It's hard to tell.
What I think is happening is that the son on his computer, the father Baker and Patrick shared
Father Baker and Patrick shared
an early memory of fishing, and so Patrick developed this fondness for fishing that he associated with his father. Patrick develops or mods a fishing game. You come to understand that he is exceptionally gifted in IT, is what they say.
Did you say IT?
In IT. So whatever the fuck that means. But
they said math.
They do, but
they say math, but they say specifically like he is like gifted in the IT department or something like that. And then
wink. What?
And then and then you start seeing on his screen like a coding
interface. Yeah, he is actually coding.
He's typing in code, and you don't really see what the effects are on his computer. But you see that he's like constantly typing code. And then in Baker's world, things are starting to get a little weird.
There's also, if you're paying attention, you can see sliders on his screen for like plant life and water density or whatever. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
As if he's running like a proc gen world creator, you know, as if he's playing Dwarf Fortress or something, where he's like, all right, let me turn up the amount of plants on this next generation or whatever. Mm-hmm. Which doesn't make sense given
you don't really see that. You don't like the
it's
change.
It's off to the side. You have to be paying attention.
Yeah. The change that happens in Baker Dale's world isn't like physical things around him are changing.
It's
like,
not Inception.
The physicality of everything is the same. What's changing is like his awareness and like his interactions with people he starts to question.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically, he becomes aware that he's in some sort of simulation, and the underlying plot that happened is that Baker passed away. Oh, should I say this now? Yeah. I guess I just already started.
Yeah.
Baker passed away in duty in the war, and so he never actually came home. And after that, his mother remarried a construction worker named Frank Zacharias or whatever his name is. And so Patrick lives with them. So in the game, the father is painted, or the stepdad is painted as this like mogul billionaire, basically. also abusive to his wife in the game and in Baker Dale's world.
Which again, question mark.
Which again, question mark. And so throughout this whole time.
God, that brings up a very specific question.
Mm.
Which is, sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
There is a big point. The final act is, will Baker Dale kill this motherfucker?
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes clear that this is not a killing sort of game.
Yes.
Right?
So.
Well, that's not the question yet.
Oh, okay.
So that is part of the big conflict, is the game does not want him to kill.
Yes. So however, basically, Patrick is manipulating the game to change the objective, the main objective, the main motivation of Baker Dill to be killing Frank.
Right.
Instead of catching
justice.
Catching justice.
Right. Here is my huh.
Hmm.
Yet abuse is within the realms of the game?
Or is that a mod?
You think he modded that in also?
He
must have. But the game doesn't.
If it's his mother and his stepfather, well, those have to that. Be inherently modded.
Totally.
Right?
But there's no, like, the world isn't struggling to hold them. Like, stop. Like, do you know what I mean?
We don't see any specific stuff happening in the game. It's told.
That is not true.
There is
abusive shit happening in that game, my guy.
Well,
yeah. We don't see. You hear her be hit. With his belt.
Yeah, and
two,
you see...
there is lots of emotional abuse happening throughout and physical touching that is abusive.
But it was like things that could be told, I thought of it as things that could be told through text in the game, right?
Right.
Rather than things that needed to be modded mechanically.
But it's not, but I think because of how, like, I think everything that happens in Baker Dale's world is just in the game.
Right.
Like, explicitly, visually... Like, what if, you know, you're walking over here, you see that animation of this person walking over there, like...
Yeah.
So, I think... And, I mean, this is, like, the... absolute messiest shit.
Yeah.
Is, you know... everyone knows. The game, like, everyone around Baker is talking to him about this woman who's come in to town. And she's getting, you know, everyone's talking about the fact that she's being abused.
Yeah.
And specifically bringing that up to Baker. And Baker, at first, is like, it's not my problem. And he's, like, focused on this fish. And slowly, he, like, kind of realizes that, no, he does need to step in. Because he starts to realize that this is a call for help from his son.
Right.
And he has this ability, like an ability in like the most abstract sense, not like he's directly communicating.
Right. Not like he's M. Night Shyamalan's character. And this is his Sella power.
Exactly. He has the ability to speak sort of to Patrick. So a lot of the time you see Baker like just talking to no one, but he's talking to Patrick. And so I would say that like everything that's happening in the game is happening for Patrick. Like
right.
Patrick is seeing
Patrick
all of
is
this.
Making this and Patrick is making this game do this, whether it's his game or it's a mod, because he's processing the trauma of living through an abusive household.
Right.
And like, is it like garnering the courage to like retaliate
this is a movie in which Baker Dill gained consciousness, so I don't fucking know.
Yeah.
Well, and that's, I mean, the movie's a mess. Like,
yeah,
like is he building, working up the nerve to do this, or does he want to see if there's a threshold at which his father would have killed this guy, at which point it's sort of he's going to a virtual mentor to see what is the action I should take here.
Mm-hmm.
But this begins to get so fucking weird. So things I do like here. One of the reasons that this all begins to feel so weird for McConaughey's character, it's like it suddenly dawns on him that he's in a video game fishing town where like there's the one doctor and you go to him for the one sort of interaction. There is the sailor's hangout bar and you go there and you see the same people every day and you have the same conversations. There is the bait shop and it realizes that he's in this world of like just two-dimensional characters who like have these really transactional simple relationships, and that begins to justly like freak him out as the awareness of that hits home. It's kind of nifty, like, yeah, that's a very video game thing to have happen. Where it begins getting, where it gets extremely messy as hell.
Yeah, I mean,
is so Karen shows up one night to really do the hard sell to explain why, like, her first attempt to commission the killing doesn't go well. She shows up again to really sell on the idea of murdering Frank. And a couple things come across in this conversation. One, she says she still loves Baker and she wished things had gone differently. And Baker says straight up, what does differently look like? You mean like I didn't go over there? I didn't end up in pieces all around the desert or something like that, which is this weird, like, is he talking about his own death in the war? And no character really like reacts to that revelation in the scene.
Yeah, I didn't even really catch that.
And then she explains to him that Patrick is involved, that Patrick is in danger, and this needs to happen for Patrick. But then there is, and this is the other part of a movie like this, there's got to be some kind of like sexual tension and chemistry between the leads. We get a intensely awkward and uncomfortable sex scene between McConaughey and Hathaway that is like, if you remember the True Detective sex scene, it's like that level of semi-engaged, semi-voluntary. And then when he finishes, he hops off her and says, I did it. I proved I'm better, or something like that. Like, he basically says, I did it. I beat him.
Yeah. This is also the point at which we see like belt lashes on the back of Anne Hathaway, and like after seeing those lashes is when Baker like engages in sex with her and then like says that at the end, like he says like I'm better than him or something, like I am something like that. And here's, I'm like trying to think of what game is this, and I'm like, is this GTA with a fishing mod, or is this like The Sims, and you don't like see the dialogue, but you just like the actions are being done, and there's a fishing mod.
I mean, it could be The Sims with a dialogue, right?
Yeah, but the dialogue is like Simlish, right?
So you I'm saying it could be The Sims, but they're speaking English. You can imagine that game exists.
And but there's definitely an implication that there's AI, right?
Like, there's absolutely AI. That's like the thing that makes me like, this is such a, I understand that if you're listening to this and you're not into games, which is some small subset of our audience. Mm-hmm. Hi, mom. Hi, dad. It's like, why are you focusing on the game implication here? The game part of this when you could just be unpacking questions of abuse and parenthood and blah, blah, blah. And I think that's part of it. But I think that the movie wants you to think about the rules. It wants you to think about the ways in which characters have game-like compulsions that they are moved by, and it wants you to try to extrapolate out and like say something about the world in general, right? Mm-hmm. But like, it doesn't really do any of that super successfully.
Yeah.
And so there is a way in which I am moved to try to figure out what the fuck is this game? Like,
but also,
how would you model all of this, and what does that mean for the outcomes for these characters and the themes?
And also, given that it was Patrick's doing, like all of it is Patrick's doing, right?
Yes.
Isn't like.
Yes,
because it's all being everything that we've watched was right, like that makes the way that these things play out.
If this is GTA, a game that already has cutscenes with violence in it,
right,
that already gestures at sexual assault, there's a degree to which you're saying, aha, here's the canvas with which he's working with.
Right.
Yeah, this is already a mechanic within the game.
Right. Right.
You're just putting a different player skin on it. And like,
Which is like the review that Patrick Klepek read to us suggested that he was playing a game as his father, of playing a fishing game as his father. But watching the movie, that is not necessarily clear. In fact, I think he's building the game. I would lean on the side of he's built this game wholesale, that he's built Plymouth, a sort of open world game or a simulation game in which there are sub games to play or sub quests to go do.
Mm-hmm. Catch the cat,
blah, blah, blah.
I forget the other ones.
Get the tuna. I don't fucking. Yeah, they're all
have sex with your mom.
Have sex with your mom. Have sex with Constance.
Weird.
He's a teen. Yeah, he's making some sex games.
Well, that's the other thing is that it feels like fucking. It's hard to tell what. Because the movie, obviously, shot with real actors, real people in the real world. But
and
when you see
by a human, not
when you see shots of the game on his computer screen, it's fucking first person, really like
super bright, super saturated, colorful.
And so you wonder how much of like what is being shown in the movie is a. It could be like a text dump. Like this is the story that's happening.
No, because, I think it's reboot.
I think it's reboot. It's showing all these things, but like in that style. Like...
No, sorry. What I mean is, do you know reboot? Do you know reboot? Okay, so reboot.
I know reboot.
Was. Thank you, Rob. This is I'm not dragging you. Reboot was a CG show from the early '90s in which the characters lived inside. It's like Tron. Characters lived inside of a computer, and when a game happened, they get loaded into the game. Like they're like living in
like Wreck-It Ralph.
Sort of. It's sort of like Wreck-It Ralph. The big difference is like there is a computer world where everyone lives. And then the user's like, I gotta load a game. And then this guy, the protagonist dude, becomes the protagonist in this new game. Or he becomes a protagonist. He's like, oh, now I'm a scuba fisherman.
I see.
Now I'm a laser king. Okay. Whatever. You know, scuba fisherman, laser king.
Yeah, the two jobs.
The two jobs. And the thing I'm getting at is more like, in my mind, I think he's built a world. He's built Dwarf Fortress. The world runs, or you can step in and play as one character in that world. And I think he goes between those two things and sees what happens sometimes, and other times goes fishing.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, you see him... The sort of perfect example is when Baker is waking up in the morning.
Yes.
And it's, like, just before 5 or something like that. Like, every morning... there's, like, one other scene... previous where the alarm clock goes off and he like hits it and wakes up and goes to
and the
fish.
Radio DJ comes on
and the radio DJ comes
day
in
Plymouth
and it's like the same
go catch that fish
it's like weirdly directed specifically towards Baker but in this scene he wakes up just before the clock and he's unable to get out of bed, like physically he's like glued to the bed and like can't get up. And that's what makes me think it's kind of like what you're talking about. Talking about Austin, in which like when you play The Sims, you can physically click on one character and like tell them to do something.
Get the fuck out of bed.
Get the fuck out of bed, even if it's like not really, you know, their time to wake up yet. They're still tired or whatever. Their sleep meter's not all the way up. But, or you can just like let them be.
Right. And sometimes they'll get up early anyway because they have insomnia or whatever, and they might just not be able to sleep a full night or.
But that's a rule.
But that's a rule. Rules. Right. But rules, in other words, like, the thing that is interesting about this for me is Patrick, like Rob said, working up the courage by trying to enact the killing before he goes and does it himself? Or is he running a system and being like, well, if my dad can do it, I can do it? And to what degree is he disclaiming his responsibility in what follows? Do you know what I mean?
I don't think he is disclaiming his responsibility. I think I would almost look at the game as like a coping mechanism in which he's working through the sort of emotions of like feeling like he wants to retaliate like violently and you know, like watching. I mean... For some, you know, survivors of abuse, it can be very therapeutic to walk through, you know, the past traumas and things like that.
Sure.
And sort of, you know, there's all sorts of different ways to cope with that sort of stuff and to work through it. But so I think, you know, at the end, it is revealed that Patrick has had this knife the whole time, and he is like listening to Karen and Frank like fight, and he gets up from his room and leaves the room and goes and presumably like we don't see this, like stabs his stepfather and kills him. And then in the like not the trial, but in the like crime analysis or
the
whatever,
final
the final
epilogue, that's like, hey,
it's
here's
like
what happened.
Yeah, it's like, oh, well, you know, a child was charged with second degree murder. His mother has come out to say that it was an act of defense because the stepfather was abusive. And so to me, what this reads like is that kind of coping narrative or like that reenaction almost. The thing is, I'm not sure. It doesn't do a good job. And I'm not sure if I'm not sure if it's successful in that. I'm not sure if, you know, it really lands what it's trying to do, because it's just so disturbing to think of, you know, because Patrick is not putting himself in the game. Patrick does not put himself in the game until the very end.
And he also puts a younger version of himself in the game.
Yeah. Like to reenact like the fishing days of when his father was like still around.
Yeah. But even that is ambiguous, because I couldn't read that as, I couldn't be sure if I wanted to read that as, now Patrick is going to play a game in which he is a kid self playing the game with his father, or if this was his final gift to the now conscious version of his father,
right,
giving him a new compulsion, which is hang out with your kid and go fishing and you don't have to be sad anymore and go to this new island.
But the fact is that like he created his mother and his stepfather and like had them reenact these. It's also interesting that he like wrote this father character to be sort of this, like, his power comes from his wealth.
Given that his own father was a construction worker, which is construction workers can make good money, but in film and in
like
pop
the trope,
culture,
of construction workers,
it's always
usually
a
blue collar
worker,
like lower middle class or like just middle class probably. And so, yeah, I mean, it was deeply disturbing to sit through some of the scenes in this movie. And I don't think I really got the catharsis that the movie wanted me to get by the end at all. So much of it was just so convoluted in how like the AI or whatever, like the game was changing. Like you see sort of Baker Dill like taking off randomly. We'll just like kind of like having these random outbursts and things like that. And it just, there was so many like beats that I couldn't like follow it all the way through to like a final catharsis, because I was just getting pulled in so many directions.
It like retraces its own steps a lot in the back half. It like does the turn and it's like, it's a video game, but then it like stays there and it wants to reintroduce like a degree of like obstacles between what you now understand is the final question, which is, will Baker Dill do this or not? Will Patrick do this or not? And it's just like, it doesn't ever really want, it just doesn't go from the point at which it could go.
It tries to do this reveal of being the game
three times or something.
Like, yeah, like you already did it. And then, but then like, you're supposed to go through this moment of doubt where it's like, was that real? I don't know. Like, maybe he is the real world. But like, it's too, like, that doesn't work for something, for this sort of leap. Like, that the leap is too big for it to have been like, once someone said this is a video game, you're like, yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. But the next turn is like, are the characters going to realize it too?
Right.
Yeah. Well, and you can't do this thing that the movie tries to do where the world fights back and tries to convince him that, oh, you're just Baker Dill, you're just losing it, man. Why don't you get out there and catch that fish and you'll feel better. You'll feel better, man. Because two things have happened. One, we have revealed the overarching conceit for this movie, which is that all of this is a video game. And two, the other reason there's no putting that genie back in the bottle is that you've drawn attention to the fact that, damn, none of this really makes any sense. And this world is full of two-dimensional characters.
Yeah.
But then the movie wants us to continue caring about how the action is going to resolve within the simulation. And this is the other problem with this, is we keep having that, is this murder going to happen? Is he going to go through with it? And the problem is, at this point, what we have here is a not very convincing and certainly not very engaging, like neo-noir. And then it is tied to this really troubling meta text that sort of tipped its hand. And so immediately you're in neither story. At this point, you are fully in the, what the fuck is happening here? Mm-hmm. Like what is the metaphor that I'm watching at this point? And then it goes all in on trying to get you invested in the procedural element of killing this dude off. There are twists of fate and fortune as they try to arrange this guy being sent off to his death on the water. And then the game itself begins to try and prevent the murder. Austin, you want to talk? Pardon?
Well...
Go ahead.
I was just going to say the fact that, you know, here's another troubling thing for me is that the point at which Baker finally has the ability to kill Frank is when Frank has been completely like debilitated by being like set up for like a hit by the first mate. So he's like injured in his face and he has a broken hand. And he's like super fucked up on like medications and like alcohol and things like that. And that's the point at which like Baker's like, all right, now I can kill him. Like now that he's like completely helpless and like can't fight back against me is like when I'm going to put him in the boat and just like push him off the edge, basically.
See, the thing is, the part for me, part of the reason why that doesn't bother me is because Karen is active in setting that up. Which is to say,
well, Karen wasn't active in setting up the.
No, but she absolutely got him to that boat and is a participant. It is not like that doesn't happen. Baker Dill would not go to that hotel and finish him off. You know what I mean? And so for me, that didn't bug me because it was Karen who made sure that who saw an opportunity and took an opportunity to push him into place. Now, I still go ahead.
How she does that is again through one of the most exquisitely awkward scenes in this movie.
Totally.
So Duke sets up, he doesn't want Baker to kill this guy. So what he arranges, there's an element, the movie starts to make passing reference to there being sexual tourism happening in this world, abuse of sex workers, or just abuse of poor people, all of these things.
Also of like young.
They word girls, which is meant to be ambiguous, but it's meant to be ambiguous in a very gross way.
So
again, just in the game, though not pictured in the game. So maybe Kato's text theory.
I get you, but is it
Duke,
like,
I don't give a fuck, kind of.
Yeah.
So Duke catches wind that this guy is going to be prowling around the poor side of the island or whatever it is. And Duke arranges for the guy to get disablingly injured so he can't go fishing and get murdered by Baker. And that happens. And Frank ends up all fucked up back in the hotel the morning he's supposed to go back out on the water and get murdered. Karen sees this. And he is like, appears to be drunk, concussed, and his hand is just ripped open and beat to shit. And to convince him that he can get out on the water and he should go out on the water and go fishing, she asks him, just choke me. She says,
to prove that he has the grip to hold the fishing rod, which throughout the entire film is like the biggest phallic symbol again and again and again in terms of clear placement and stuff like that.
And then she utters the immortal line, "I want my daddy to catch me a big fish."
God, it's really bad.
Famous last words.
It's really bad.
It's so bad. And so you get this scene of Jason Clark just playing like concussed and totally out of it. Sort of lazily choking Anne Hathaway as she repeatedly invokes, "Daddy, catch me a fish. Choke me, daddy." And then he's like, "Yeah, you know what? I can go fishing," and goes down to the boat. And that's how all that transpires.
Right.
And I will say at that point, that was one of the few moments this movie was paying off on, like, see, this is the kind of good bad movie shit I needed to be happening more in this film, because it's like laughable and weird and goofy and doesn't work at all. I was like, I could have used more of that rather than just the wall-to-wall disturbing shit that tends to encompass that moment.
I mean, for me, the reason why the question for me there was not like why does he have to be, you know, in this like vulnerable state in order for this to happen? Is that like, what does that represent on a larger scale right. for Patrick mm-hmm. in the sense that, is this the game fighting back against him? Like, is this sure. like, is this Duke and the rules of the game, like trying to adapt in a way to stop this from happening? Or is this all scripted? And that's what's kind of,
right.
That's like the thing that I kind of got stuck on is like, is this being written out to the extent that like Karen also has like some sort of, presence and like agency in sort of, you know, exiting this abusive situation.
Right.
Is it that, you know, he just wants Frank to get everything that's coming to him and
right,
more
right.
like, and so, yeah, that's why I brought that up.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, that's part of why I'm like confused. Like that's part of the thing it does really bad is like understanding where the, like what translation are we making? Right. Like, are we translating this as like, this is literally happening in the game? Or are we translating some of these things as metaphor for things that happen in games? Is it that the game actually, quote unquote, broke the hands of the avatar of his stepfather?
Right.
Or is it like, there's a bug that won't let me finish this quest line?
Right.
And it's in the movie presented to us as this other thing. Like,
yeah,
right. Like,
I think we have to take it on face value, which is it happened
right.
in the game. Everything else that happens happens in the game, right? I don't think we ever get anything.
But then it doesn't. It makes even less sense, right? Like,
I mean,
that's part of the failing.
You see the bug in the like NPC character, the store owner, like repeating lines
right.
of dialogue.
Right. But that also happened in the game. Like,
that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
is
yeah,
like
yeah.
that's like
yes.
proof that like what's. Like any sort of like inconveniences or like
right.
like coming up to walls or stuff like that is being represented.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, when you see like what the map looks like and things like that, like
right.
that's
I
like
I love that fucking scene
that's
so
such
much.
Such a good scene.
I genuinely love. There's a sequence where people who haven't seen this movie. There's a sequence where Baker Dill has been told. So we skipped like my favorite part of this movie. There was like
Sorry.
A 15 minute part of this movie that I genuinely love, which is where he finally sits down to talk to Reed, what's his name? Reed Miller, who is a fishing who's a representative from a fishing company, from a fishing equipment company,
mm-hmm.
who comes to give him a special fish finder on loan to try out to find the fish. And in the ensuing conversation, Reed says, he slips up and he says, I forget the exact exchange, I forget how McConaughey sets up the thing, but he says, I am the rules. And he's like, what'd you just say? He said, I know the rules. and what he reveals is he is the rules of the game. He represents the rules of the game and what they want to happen, how the game has been programmed, how the design functions.
Mm-hmm.
And he is not a killer. He's a fisherman. He has been programmed to have a compulsion to fish, to have the verbs to fish, not the verbs to kill people. And in this conversation,
and the verbs to fuck.
That's it. He's a fucker and a fisher. Put it above my bed. fucking and fishing.
In this God home.
And what ensues after that is McConaughey's character Baker Dill trying to figure out if that's true. And one of the ways he does that is by looking at his maps the next morning. And he looks at his first map, which is small. It's a close up of Plymouth.
It's the small bear.
It's the
baby bear.
It's the baby bear, but it's also the Ubisoft map, like 100% a Ubisoft map of like nodes and roads. And like, oh, the yellow points all around the place. You definitely go there to get collectibles. The cat is definitely a collectible, by the way. You've collected
it
100 times. And then he's like, wait a second. This is all. Where is Plymouth? Where the fuck is Plymouth? And he gets a bigger map, and it's like it just zoomed
Mama
out.
Mama bear.
It's like Plymouth. It just says Plymouth. It's just the one
and there's
island.
There's just water around it.
Right. And he's like, I know. I'll get my good map. And he Papa Bear map. Goes to the top of like a pile of shit, like at the cabinet. Pulls down this gigantic paper thing. Opens it up. Puts a lantern on one side. Knifes the other corner to try to keep it open. Opens it up. Puts two more things down, including his world's best dad cup.
Yes.
Which early in the movie, I was pretty sure it said world's best dad. Add question mark, then the question mark disappears. I have to rewatch this movie sadly to see if that's true. And it's just Plymouth tiny in a fucking vast
and it's,
ocean.
And it's the same exact graphic. 100%.
Yeah. It's so good.
It's like the same fucking waypoints, the same
everything. I can,
like, everything is the same. It just has more water around it.
The way an open world game will just be, oh, I guess this is on an island with water forever.
Yeah.
Shrug. And that ends up being, like, the stuff where he goes to talk to the shopkeeper and, like, talks to the old barman. And,
like, he, like, sits in the spot that is, like, the old man's spot. And he's like, that's the old man's spot. And he's like, I don't give a fuck.
And it ends with a great conversation between Jeremy Strong and Matthew McConaughey, in which he convinces the rules to be on his side, basically. He kind of lays out the situation, and at the end of it, there's just a great moment where he's like, what is this? Have you written this down? What is this?
My Apple Watch just caught everything I was saying.
Great.
It says shopkeeper, like, talk to, and he likes it in the spot that is an old man. That's like, that's the old man, but he's like, I don't give a fuck. I don't answer the great conversation between.
Thanks, Siri.
Thank you.
Fire lyrics.
And the great conversation where he basically convinces him the rules, like, I guess we changed the rules. I guess we're just, you know, you're a killer now, basically.
Yeah.
And that conversation, one, had great energy. I shipped those two characters in mod. They get together and ride off into the sunset to go fishing. And there was just, oh, wow. They, like, showed up to have performances. They showed up to have any sort of charisma and rapport with each other, and I wanted that movie more.
Yeah, totally.
Rob, you sound like you had something to go with that sequence.
No, I was worried we were going to get to that scene. It is probably the strongest scene in the movie, where basically he convinces the rules. And I love that the guy's disguised. The rules are disguised so basically as the in-game vendor. Where it's like, you want the top of the line fish sonar, I've got it right here for you.
Right, it's the JPEG that would be next to best value in the mobile game, holding the, like, oh yes, you spent $4.99, you get the XP doubler, you get the double fish finder or whatever.
Yep.
But yeah, the shot of them both just sitting in the surf, drinking the rum, and the rules flinging the bottle out and be like, fuck it.
It comes back, thankfully. I was a little worried about, there's a little rum left in that bottle. Yep. It's not going to get drunk. that sequence is good.
So it culminates in, there's so much, this is such a weird fucking movie. For some reason, they go out on the water. Diane Lane's character has a nephew who wants a job on a boat. He's just there. He's just there for some reason.
That's bad. Well, it's the rules. The rules don't want him to, this is the confusion of this part too. The rules don't want him to kill this guy. And so they start giving him things that are either incentivizing other sorts of play or are roadblocks, like the kid who shows up who's like, oh, I'm just on the boat now, which means you can't kill this guy in front of me because you'll get in trouble. But like, with who?
Yeah, the cop's out of town for the weekend.
One cop is out of town. Jeez.
So, anyway, who should arrive in the middle of the scene but the fish known as Justice? Matthew McConaughey asks some leading questions, basically being like, talk shit about my son some more, asshole. And Jason
Karen is just keeps calling him John, which is his former name. Like, I guess he changed his name when he came to Plymouth to Baker Dill from, like, John Stamos or whatever.
That's him, John Stamos.
And just keeps calling him John in front of her, like, new husband. And he's like, why are you calling him John? And it's like, just stop calling him John for, like, two fucking seconds.
Jason Clarke does a very good job of looking like a guy who people are trying to ask to leave a bar without him ever realizing he's being kicked out. Just like, what? What do you mean? John? Who's John? And then the tuna gets on the line and he's like, give me that line. Give me that line. And Matthew McConaughey is like, yeah, you want this fish, fucker? And he's like, it's all yours. And he has... So when you go trophy fishing like this, blue water fishing like this, you wear a fishing harness so that you are basically, like, strapped to the line. And you're also supposed to be,
use, like, your, like, body weight to, like, pull, because these fish are just gigantic.
You're also supposed to be anchored to the boat for that same reason, so that what happens at the end of this movie doesn't happen to you, which is he unhooks him from the boat, but he is strapped to the line. He's locked in. And Justice, that crafty devil, yanks Frank over the side and down to his death. And then we cut to the bedroom. Like, basically, like, it's almost like we go straight from that scene.
Yeah.
To Patrick.
Do we get the eye zoom out? Do we get the zoom out into the eye, or is that later?
It opens like, on the zoom.
It returns to it a second time. We realize it's the screen, but that might have been the reveal. Anyway, it doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. Anyway, Patrick stands up from the computer, goes and gets a knife, leaves his bedroom, and then we get to a series of summaries about what happened.
Yeah.
We get the police report about Patrick murdering his abusive stepfather, and then we get, in the game, Anne Hathaway's character explaining some of what happened, and there's a chance Patrick and Baker can be together. And then the world begins deconstructing and begins breaking into polygons.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Remember when I said it wasn't like Inception? Well,
yeah, it begins breaking into polygons, and the world's like unraveling, and it's very bad. Like, it's an extremely shitty and cheesy
bad,
effect.
Yeah.
And then the phone rings, McConaughey picks it up, and it's Patrick on the other end, explaining to him that he basically got off with a minimal sentence, he'll be released, and they can be together.
Mm-hmm. Is he talking? Did Patrick talk?
That's him on the phone, yeah.
Yeah.
Totally.
Oh, yeah.
And the movie ends with McConaughey back on the boat, and Patrick comes running down the dock.
Little boy Patrick.
Yeah.
It is not the teen Patrick that we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Kleppet-sized.
Kleppet's, yeah. Uh-huh.
What's confusing to me during that polygon sequence is, like, nothing is changing.
No. Nope. It's bad.
Like, nothing, nothing.
It looks like it should be being broken apart and reconfigured in some new way.
All that's happening is, like, all these polygons are, like, swirling around Matthew McConaughey, and it's, like, just going and going and going like this windstorm. But, like, the things that should be what the polygons are coming from, like, all the infrastructure around him isn't changing. And then also, like, later when fucking Patrick ends up in the game, like, nothing's different. Like,
There's a new island. That island is not the same island. There's a difference in height, the one that they're piloting out to. So, Serenity 2.
No.
Serenity
2.
The franchise.
Franchise.
There's no chance.
The mom is hacking the game. She wants
Patrick's
revenge.
Having a tough time in his honors courses.
Yep.
I need you to catch a fish called advanced placement.
In APIT.
Yeah, APIT. Yep.
My favorite class.
God. So I will say, so Stephen Knight, the thing is, this movie made a little more sense when I looked up the things he's written.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
So one of the best things he's been a part of, and now I'm reconsidering my love of this admittedly trashy things, Peaky Blinders.
Yep.
The Cillian Murphy vehicle. But more importantly, more relevant to this,
Rob,
at least.
I can't do this twice. Is it Cillian or is it it's Cillian? It's a hard K? I've been saying this one wrong.
I thought it was Cillian.
I also have been saying Cillian.
Yeah.
Google or Wikipedia says Rob is right.
Damn.
This is not like ciabatta bread. Ciabatta. Rob has got this one right.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, good.
I know my Irish slightly better than my Italian breads. Anyway, so Stephen Knight is also the writer for two movies that you can see the connections to this one. One 100%. Is, I think it's Robert Zemeckis, Allied.
Which I have not seen. That I have not seen.
Brad Pitt and Marion Cotillard. Is that it?
Yeah, totally.
Cotillard.
And then he made that disastrous Bradley Cooper chef movie called Burnt.
Oh, see, I'm going somewhere else with this, but that's interesting.
So he makes... So the thing is, like...
What's Burnt's deal? I don't know Burnt at all.
Burnt is like... What if you valorize the most toxic... Like, asshole.
Never underestimate a man with everything to lose.
That right. It's basically
okay.
The biggest shithead chef in the world,
mm-hmm.
Burned out years ago, disgraced mm-hmm. himself. He's done serving his penance, though. He has served no real penance. He just shucked a bunch of oysters, and he said when he shucked a million, he would go back to cooking. That's his penance. He didn't actually make amends to anybody. He just went and shucked a million oysters. And then when he shucks a million, he walks out of the restaurant and he goes back to get that third Michelin star. And it's all about his mission to get his third Michelin star. And it reveals the degree to which he's learned nothing. He's still an asshole to everybody. He abuses his staff. He abuses everyone who comes into his orbit. And this is all portrayed as heroic and, like, inspiring. The movie probably is famous for just one scene in which Bradley Cooper thinks he's lost the chance at getting his third Michelin star from a bad film, from a bad restaurant review. And he goes to his rival, the American's Matthew Reese's restaurant, which does have a third Michelin star, and attempts to kill himself with, I believe, saran wrap. Oh, he attempts to kill himself in this guy's restaurant, either using a plastic bag or saran wrap. And Matthew Reese and he, like, they're acting the shit out of this patently ridiculous scene as Bradley Cooper pretends to try to choke himself with a plastic bag. And it's extremely, again, Dan Aykroyd in that SNL skit. Where it's like, Johnny Spaceman. It's extremely that, but, like, played dead serious. Anyway, so the thing is, like, Stephen Knight makes these,
so this is the one that I want to connect to is Eastern Promises, which he wrote.
Okay.
Cronenberg's 2007 film, which is about the Russian mafia sex trafficking and some other things that are a little over his... Well, so Eastern Promises is a movie that I remember enjoying and on a formal level in terms of some of the choreography in the fight scene or two, the way the light was used. And I remember leaving the theater being positive on it. But that was in 2007, which was 12 years ago. And it's a film that, like the film that Cronenberg did before Eastern Promises, A History of Violence, I have come to think, I bet on revisiting it, there would be points at which I would want to eject. The things in which I don't think are handled particularly well. I mean, History of Violence has, like, some particular scenes that I suspect would be revolting to me now that were at the time more provocative and, ooh, this is intense. Then now I'd be like, oh, I just don't, nah, I'm
Ed
good.
Ed Harris's face getting caved in is still, like, one of the worst things I've ever seen.
Dude.
So.
Yeah, totally. There's, like, the stairwell scene. There's a bunch of stuff in that movie that's like, whew, yeah, okay. Eastern Promises is a film that I remember already feeling was, like, not necessarily deft, but was surprising and exciting. And I think this is a film that wants some of that excitement, wants to throw around terms like sex trafficking and sexual tourism without, like, digging in. And really wants you to think about, like, wants you to have thought about violence, but not necessarily have done the work to introduce any new ideas around it, or confront any of the complexities therein. I don't know. Like, it is, I don't know. It's no Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Natalie Watson.
His next upcoming movie, y'all?
Oh, no.
Just Stephen Knight? Yeah.
World War Z 2.
Listen, get paid. David Fincher is directing that, so.
What?
Apparently.
You're shitting me.
I'm not. What? I'm not.
Okay, hold on. Let's think about World War Z. Which subplot in that is the most
interesting? I never read it.
It's interesting.
I don't think I watch the Brad Pitt movie? Did I?
So did World War Z, the original, the one with Brad Pitt, is that just one of the timelines and one of the plots in the book?
No, it's nothing like that. So the book is...
It's a collection, right? It's like an anthology from a different perspectives?
Right. It's basically it's like a Studs Terkel oral history of the zombie war. But it's all from, this is actually what makes it kind of a cool book. It's Max Brooks kind of looking at what is going to end the world from the standpoint of, like, the neoliberal order. Like, what are all the threats that we are not addressing that we are ill-equipped to face, the things that we're allowing to fester? All of those will become catastrophic and lead to our destruction in the zombie war. That's what World War Z is. It tells all these stories from all these different perspectives to illuminate a different way in which the world fell apart. The Brad Pitt movie is basically, what if zombies attacked the world?
Right.
And that's it. That's the movie. Brad Pitt is just the hero fighting the zombie plague. And it has, like, no, like, literally no resemblance to any of the stories in the book. Huh. But
it will be filmed this June, the sequel. So we'll see how that goes.
Very curious. World War Z was, like, a legendarily troubled production, too.
Oh, I fucking bet.
Yeah. Okay, so Stephen Knight, good luck with World War Z, possibly
good luck with your life.
God.
Yeah.
Is that it?
So I guess for me, the thing I do want to say is this tripped over the line to so bad it's good for me. Not good, but so bad I'm entertained in trying to piece together these questions. Mm-hmm. I think it is not a redeemed film. I don't think this is a film I'm recommending people go see. And unlike some other so bad they're good films where I am like, oh, it'll be a good time. Have some people over, get some popcorn, get some beer. This is not what that is. It isn't campy enough. It doesn't lean in hard enough. But I will say that, like, having come off of Split and Glass, Split especially was really hard for me to get through because of the stakes, because the stakes were so high constantly. Knowing that so much of this was happening inside of the world of a game and this was someone who was working through shit, there was a degree to which I was interested in the artifice. I was all the way through. There's things we talked about very briefly up top, but there are these wild camera swings throughout this movie where it goes from almost a third-person video game perspective behind the character to the like side profile shot. There are moments where it feels like you've entered a cutscene or we talked about a dialogue box with a character. Mm-hmm. There are all the artifice of the island becomes fascinating for me to watch and wondering where is this poor filmmaking and where is this kind of clever. Where is this playing with the constraints of games? I don't think it's good at this stuff. I don't think that it's even insightful necessarily so much as it's like, it really is, that's Chappie. It's, oh, look, that's a side quest. Oh, yeah. Look, that's a dialogue box.
I also don't know if a lot of that would land for like the majority of the audience.
For gamers?
No. For like,
we're all gamers now, right? Natalie.
For moviegoers everywhere.
Stephen Knight is 60 years old. He's a true gamer.
I understand, but I worry that like those, like specifically those camera pans,
yeah,
would be like, what the fuck?
Yeah, totally.
To like people that don't understand what it looks like to move your mouse like 180 degrees to be a gamer. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't think this is a movie for anyone but gamers.
Gamers only. But also gamers don't watch this.
But also gamers don't watch this because this movie was really hard to watch.
Yeah.
My ending thought is, can people chill with fucking, can people chill with fucking?
With fucking.
Yeah.
No, that's not it. Can people chill with abuse, overly sensationalized, like sexual and physical abuse? Can we chill with that? I'm tired of it in 2019 personally, and especially if it's not gonna fucking make me feel cathartic about like being a survivor like myself, like if I'm not feeling like, I don't know, I just I'm tired of that sense of sensationalization, because I think it's extremely like raw plot or whatever. Like, I don't know. I'm thinking of like when fucking in Game of Thrones, in not the most recent season, but the season before that, that there was a like a rape scene in which that was like not in the books. And also like George R. R. Martin doesn't exactly use like rape super effectively as a narrative tool either, but this was like especially damning for the writers of the show. Mm-hmm. And so like I feel like we're in this space of like there's a lot of like sensationalization being tossed around like pretty carelessly, especially just after watching Split and Glass. And so, yeah, I'm tired of it. Let's just do better.
Uh-huh.
Because we can.
I think there's an interesting element there. I think there's a couple things happening there. One is that is a way of ducking more complicated moral universes, right? I think like it's like films like to deal to traffic in this stuff, in part because this guy's really bad. How do I show that? Well, this is the way. Like, we can all agree this is bad.
Yeah. And this is a video game, so we don't have to like super, super confront, or like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
this is a fantasy world, or this is a supernatural world, or whatever. Like, these are still like real life fucking things.
And I think there's also a weird thing where if you go back to like when film noirs are coming around, like you could have detective stories and books that were like solving one crime, even a minor one, was still important to do, right? And now you have the Law and Order SVU effect where it's like we need to find the most sensational lens to cast on anything. And yeah. So we've got this train of grotesque one-upsmanship. You know, throughout a lot of entertainment. Where I'm at is this movie was kind of... I think this movie would have been weird and goofy and interesting if it hadn't been playing with such loaded themes. And that's where it broke down for me, is I'm sitting there watching this movie and I'm trying to be like, boy, what a weird high concept disaster this is from Stephen Knight. But then it keeps cutting back to something really horrific and trying to weave those two things together, all for the sake of a shabby little conceit. And I think what ends
for
up
a twist it doesn't even deliver on with you know, much, honestly, with much confidence, because it has to linger. It can't just boom, here it is.
Right. And so like ultimately I think it's interesting. It's like it was an experience I am unlikely to soon forget. I didn't like this movie.
Back of the box. There you go. You fucked up, Rob. Yeah. They're going to put that shit on the fucking Blu-ray ad.
Experience that will be with me for a long time. But I'm not
Robert's
sure. I said this last week. I genuinely wasn't sure. I thought you guys should watch it because like I genuinely didn't really. The movie wasn't fun in the way I want my bad movies to be fun. But it wasn't good enough to be interesting on that sort of, you know, twisted conceptual level.
Some time out of it though.
Yeah.
I mean, when I had the same experience as you, Rob. When I first walked out, I like looked at Kato and Austin. I was like, I don't think I can talk about this for an hour or on a podcast at all, other than saying it's like bad. But
here we are.
Right.
Oh boy.
So that's it for what was that movie called?
Serenity.
Yeah. That's it for Serenity.
Don't you forget it.
Mm-hmm.
Joss Whedon.
You know, yeah, it ain't, there's a bit that I really like where Baker Dill says, like, it ain't all buttons and charts, little albatross. You know what the first rule of flying is? Love. You can learn all the math in the verse, but you take a boat in the air and you don't love, she'll shake you off just as soon as she'll turn the word of the world. Love keeps her in the air when she ought to fall down, tells you she's hurting before she keens. Makes her a home.
When the fuck did he say that?
You don't remember that part?
No, I actually think I blacked out.
So he's talking to Patrick, and he's like, don't... He's
fuck
like,
off, Austin. I'm not going to watch you gaslight Natalie at the end of this goddamn...
God,
that's from the other Serenity, Natalie.
That's from the other Serenity.
Oh, my God. There are other things I forgot,
fair. We need to do a Be Good and rewatch of Firefly, because it's so bad, but I kind of like it still. Like, there's... good so shit.
Is that the one that there's all the Funko Pops of?
Natalie, that's everything. We live in a... Do you know there's that...
We live in a society.
We live in a society.
Hey, that's Funko.
That's Funko. Hey, that's Funko. That's their slogan, right? God.
I saw Serenity before I saw Firefly, by the way.
Did you?
Really?
I may have also, actually, you know, think about it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, the operative, Chiwetel's Ejiofor's character... got me, like, I was like, hell yeah, this seems awesome. Is the show like this? No. But,
you know, there's
that, its pleasures.
William S. Burroughs quote, we live in this is a war universe, war all the time. That was the 20th century. We live in the 21st century. This is a Funko universe. Funko's all the time.
True.
All right, well.
I have, like, never mind. I don't want to talk
about
it.
How many Funkos do you have?
I need to sell them all. Please, someone buy.
Wait, did you
30 plus Funkos.
Why do you have 30 Funkos?
Because I worked at GameStop. I worked at GameStop when the Funkos were hot. And I would look across the way with my fucking $10 paycheck an hour. And I would say, you know what I really need in my fucking tiny East Village apartment?
Oh, no.
My small, small box.
Who's your favorite?
My favorite Funko that I have?
Yeah.
I have Pinky and the Brain Funkos that I really like.
That's not bad.
But...
Okay.
Okay. You guys don't have to do this. You don't have to tell me
curious.
They're cool.
I have
a moving box full of Funko Pops. I don't know where the market is to sell them, but please, if someone
neither did Funko.
That's why they chose every market.
Someone please take them away from me.
You have a Titanfall one? Those are all right.
I don't have a Titanfall one. I have a lot.
We're gonna end this.
Yeah.
I have to go. I can't.
All right.
Thank you.
I thought about Titanfall. I have to go play this
game. Our thanks to... Austin, which track are we using?
This is your show.
No, it's not.
This is Patrick's show.
Mellow.
It's
a two mellow.
It's a two mellow track, though. Yeah.
Our thanks to Two Mellow for his excellent music. You can find all of that at twomellowmakes.bandcamp.com. You can keep up with all of us at waypoint.vice.com. I'm Rob Zachney. You can find me on Twitter at Rob Zachney. Austin, where can people find you?
Austin_Walker.
Natalie.
At Natalie Watson.
Cotto.
Regretting.
At @A_Cotto_appears.
Good luck with that, folks. All right, so that will wrap up this week's Be Good and Rewatch It. I think we are doing some horror films in the near future.
Event Horizon is next week. They're recording that tomorrow, I think. So that'll be out next week.
Awesome. Yeah. And then we need to do... I need a movie that I will enjoy.
I agree. You should pick the next one.
That's where I'm at.
Rob gets to pick the movie
for
movie night.
Yep.
All right, so I'm
Mom,
I'm going
it's Rob's
get...
turn on the Xbox.
It's Mom's turn.
It's Mom's turn on the Xbox?
I've been waiting for my mom to say that to me for years.
God.
Hope you've enjoyed watching Serenity, or at least hearing about Serenity with us and the experience of watching it. Be sure to rate and review us on your podcast platform of choice, if it allows such a thing. I like to think we're 5 stars. I like to think we are 100% fresh. Not the 22 that Serenity was rated, or the 25 that it may have deserved, arguably. We'll be back again very soon. Can't wait to talk more movies with this gang of weirdos.
That's us.
But until then, I want my daddy to catch a big fish.
I'm going
God
away.
Damn it.
Bye.
You see these headphones? I'm a weirdo. I'm wearing them all the time.
Totally twisted.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Nope, mine is airplane mode.
Oop, airplane mode. Airplane mode. Airplane, airplane, airplane mode.
Airplane mode. Airplane mode. Airplane mode. Digimon.
That's how it goes.
Are you just doing Just Keep Swimming?
No, we're doing Digimon.
Digital monsters.
Digimon are the champions. That's how the Digimon song goes.
What a fucking jab at Pokemon.
That's right.
Digimon are the champions.
Digimon are the champions. Fuck off, Pokemon.
Fuck off, Pokemon.
Pokemon, go fuck off.
Name 5 Digimon.
Agumon. Devilman. Devilmon. That's one of them. Angelmon. That's 3.
There you go.
So cheating.
I can do this. Renamon. That's the yellow one. Mm-hmm. It's the yellow fox one. Renamon. 100%.
Rena. Okay.
Renamon.
Yeah.
Why? What are you thinking? Is it not Renamon?
No.
I've watched like 50 episodes of a Digimon World Let's Play. I should know this. Greymon.
That, right.
Yeah, that's Renamon. I said that one.
Yeah.
Okay, we're recording right now. Sorry. What did I say? Did I say Agumon?
You already
Greymon,
said Agumon.
Like Greymon, Steel Greymon.
Yeah.
That one does all that shit.
Yeah, yeah.
But I can't think of any, like, I can't think of
Garurumon.
Disease. Yeah,
Garurumon. This was my fave.
And then where Garurumon?
Terriermon.
That one's cute.
Oh, what was the small one? Fuck. From the first one that turned into Angelmon. What was that one's name?
Patamon. Wait, is that really it?
Yeah, that's it.
That turned into Angelmon?
That's what turned into yeah.
Because the yeah, okay, fair. Digimon's all right.
Palmon.
Mm-hmm.
What's the plant one? What's the plant one?
Which one?
Oh, you'll see.
Palmon.
That's Palmon? Wait, what's Palmon turn into?
Cactus. Boxing cactus.
But what's it called?
Looking it up. It's been too long. It's been too long.
Yeah.
That was really into Digimon once upon a time.
Mm-hmm.
Used to
Next
fight those.
Next form, Togemon.
Togemon.
Or Woodmon.
Oh, Woodmon. That's a bad name.
That's a terrible name. Woodmon looked like wood.
Damn.
Look like a tree.
Looking like a plant.
All right, I'm ready to time at 45.
Yeah. I don't think you should do another one.
Wait,
54?
Cool.
Wow.
Almost there.
All right.
Digimon, digital champions. Digimon are the champions.